Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel have spent the past 30 years reviewing movies and the movie industry. Their thumbs are probably the most sought-after anatomical parts of any film critics today. In the movie industry, a thumbs up from them is like money in the bank. They've had a TV partnership for 20 years while writing for competing Chicago newspapers. Their rivalry is at the core of their relationship. Last February, I spoke with Ebert and Siskel in their hometown, Chicago. We spoke in the Thorne Auditorium on the campus of Northwestern University. The evening was a benefit for public radio station WBEZ. Let's start with the pros and cons of being a part-time couple. What?
Better than full-time.
Does that work for you, or are there times that you feel that the dynamics of the relationship kind of ever get in the way of what you want to do, or do you think it
I've enjoyed working with Gene over the years, and I think that what we do, we couldn't do apart. I mean, the dialectic is the whole point of our show. The thing that does bother me sometimes is that people tend to treat us as the two-headed film critic as if we are one person. We were in a Steven Spielberg movie once. We were a dragon named Siskbert. And I would like to, I'm sure that I speak for Gene as well, I would like to be thought of as a completely freestanding individual person, full service, one-stop film criticism. You can get it from me, you can get it from Gene, and then we come together once a week on the set instead of constantly being asked, where's your partner, as if somehow they're surprised to see you at the movies by yourself.
Right. I want to
Doesn't bother me at all. Not one bit.
Has the relationship changed over the years?
The relationship bothers me, but not the confusion of... Let me tell you what it's like. Roger's had one job, basically, for 29 years. Actually, 28 years, 11 months, and only a couple days. I've had...
Ask him square roots. He can do those,
very
too.
Good. Very good. I've had one job for 26 years and 5 months. And it's a job that requires you to be judgmental. You're judgmental all the time. Now, I'm sitting here in front of people who are bright and are judgmental, but I'm talking, with all respect to all of you who I don't know, we're talking about really judgmental all the time. And who do you think in the world, what object in the world do you think that we're the most judgmental about, other than ourselves? For you listeners, mutual pointing at each other. And it really, we're rough on each other, real rough. And I'm sure that when we're on our deathbeds, if there's time, we'll think, you know what, we were probably too rough. Probably too rough. And
then the second thought will be, but I'm glad I outlasted him. Because the funny thing is, and Gene is right, we may think that, we're friends.
Yeah.
Now, we're friends who fight all the time over everything.
I think it's a little more complex than that.
We'll
I think it's more closer to a sibling rivalry, and we both
of
think
the two
we're
statements,
smarter,
we're friends
brother.
And we fight all the time over everything. Which part of those do you think could be more complex?
Well, we'll probably get back to this a little bit later. I wanted to. We're listening to an interview with film critics Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview with film critics Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, recorded last February in Chicago at the Thorne Theater on the campus of Northwestern University. As I mentioned when I introduced you, you're the people who really like proved on television that you could do actual film reviews on TV and not just use television, you know, not just use the film as a point of departure to make bad puns and lame jokes about the movie. Nevertheless, when you're blurbed or you know, when an ad is quoting you, it's always like thumbs up or thumbs down. So whatever you say, no matter how complex your thoughts are, the industry, what they're looking for is the thumb up. Right.
Well, you know,
can you put like a financial value on one of your
Spy magazine attempted it a number of years ago, and it was very, very large amount of money. I mean, my recollection, it was in excess of $5 million.
Now, this must be very aggravating
and confusing, since many of the movies we give two thumbs up to don't make $5 million.
Right, right.
I'll tell you one thing about being quoted that way is that I would rather be quoted thumbs up than with some inane excerpt from my review that makes no sense at all. At least thumbs up means I liked it, which is basically what I'm saying.
Okay, is there anything that the industry tries to do, publicists in particular, to try to get a good review out of you, or to try to prevent you from seeing a movie because they're afraid you're going to give it a bad review and that might kill the box
office? Yes to both of those. Occasionally, movies are not screened for the press. And this almost always means that they don't think they're going to get good reviews. Occasionally, you get a movie down Periscope, starring Kelsey Grammer. The word was, no reviews for the press. Then they test screened it. They had sneak previews over the weekend, and it tested well. So suddenly they decided to have screenings because they thought, oh, we might get some good reviews. Well, that was, I mean, after all, they're in the business of selling tickets. I don't blame them. I think a studio has a perfect right to show their movie to anybody they want to or not show it to anyone they want to, and I understand that. But that was an example of where they don't want reviews, and they know exactly what they're dealing with in many cases. Paradoxically, a large percentage of the time, the movies they don't screen to the press get good reviews. For example, Tombstone. I don't know if you saw that.
I love Tombstone.
They refused to show it to the press. As a result, it opened on Christmas Day, and we both leave on vacation right after Christmas because you get all the Christmas movies open, and there's nothing ever opens in January. We had to catch up with it a few weeks later. It didn't get any reviews on its opening day. They wouldn't screen it for the press. It was one of the best movies of the year. Their policy probably denied Val Kilmer an Academy Award nomination. They didn't know it was a good movie. They'd had so much trouble making it, they confused the travail with the result.
Now, related to this, you both have done profiles of actors in addition to reviewing movies. You write feature stories. My experience is that sometimes actors are very temperamental. And that if you're not asking them questions that will help them promote their film, if you go what publicists like to call off-topic, that they'll sometimes get very temperamental and even walk out.
It didn't used to be that way. I mean, the key word in your observation is publicist. When I started, you kind of hung out with the stars. I mean, Gene and I remember a day when John Wayne came to town to see his friend Stepan Fetchett, who was dying in University of Chicago Hospital. And he called up the movie critics and said, come on over here to the Conrad Hilton and we'll drink some tequila and talk. And the four movie critics at that time turned up, you know, with our tongues hanging out, delighted to just sit around and talk with the Duke for a while. Well, these days, of course, with spin control, you'd have somebody feeding him his sound bites, you know. And I've done many interviews in the past where you really got to spend time with a person in an unstructured environment, maybe in an environment where they didn't always look their best, as, for example, the day I spent with Lee Marvin when he was dead drunk. And yet it was a very good story. He liked it. He talked to me again many times later in his career. He thought it was a good story about that day. These days, the publicists only want to present the soundbite opportunity. And the sad thing is, the lessons they've learned in promoting movies are now being used in promoting politicians, and we are getting the same spin control on politicians that we get on movie stars.
Did you have any publicists from Lee Marvin's movie call you up and say, please don't mention that he was drunk. Please don't quote certain things that he
please
said.
Please don't mention that the dog came out of his bedroom with a pair of panties in its mouth, and his girlfriend said, whose are those panties? And Lee Marvin said, Michelle, those are your panties. And she said, those are not my panties. And Marvin said, bad dog.
Did anyone ask you not to quote that?
That's right in the story. It's in there.
Any repercussions?
The publicist was there the whole time. He was going out to get more beer.
I got out of the interviewing business because of the influence of publicists to a degree, to a large degree. I was doing them all the time and enjoyed it tremendously. About 6 years ago, I'm guessing, it's about 6 years ago, a film called Postcards from the Edge by Mike Nichols came out, Meryl Streep, Shirley MacLaine. And Mike Nichols and I there's a group of journalists. Mike Nichols turns to me and says, oh, there was a lull. I said, may I ask a question to my colleagues? Because they had limited time. Go right ahead. I said, what do you mean by the last shot in Working Girl, which is a big pullback? I thought it was a great shot, a pullback from the office building. And he said, you know, one of many stories, that kind of thing. Okay. He said, what did you think of the last shot in this picture? Now he's crossing the line because I haven't reviewed the film. It's okay. And I said, well, I normally don't discuss the, but I'll be happy to. I didn't like it. I said, you summed up everything with a song. You remember Meryl Streep sings the song and everything's hunky-dory and, you know, this is an addiction film and she's even got the relationship going on with Hackman and all that. And I said, it just doesn't work that way. And fine. Now he leaves. And I explained to the other journalists, I said, well, you know, I want you to know, I actually liked the picture, it's just that I didn't like the ending. So if you see me give a positive review, I'm trying to protect myself now, please know that it wasn't that my mind changed, but he asked me about one scene, and I told him about one scene, end. The next day, interviews are canceled. And they're too busy. And including
your
Nichols.
Interview.
My interviews with Nichols, Streep, not MacLaine. So I go to Shirley MacLaine. I'm steamed. I'm steamed because, come on, this is juvenile. He asked the question. I didn't go around picking on him. I would end up writing him a letter explaining this. I got most everything in my life from writing letters. And I said, he turned around and he did an interview with me. And I'll tell you what he said, because it involves Roger, too. But back to why I got out of the business. Who needs that grief? Okay? Who needs it? Shirley MacLaine said, Gene, we're all performers, and these interviews are included in our performances. We're trained to charm you. Okay? This isn't the real us. This is a performance that we're giving you. All your public cares about is what you think of the movies, not about us. Forget the interviews. Just focus on reviewing. And basically, she gave me I do have a lot of respect for, always did, and it gave me license to do what I wanted to do. And I wrote a column explaining my exiting from the interview process about this story. What Mike Nichols said was, he said, you guys, he says, I said, why are you making such a big deal about me? You know, I mean, you know, he says, well, because you can actually affect, this comes back to your earlier question, he says, you can actually affect the box office.
Well, I bet you've learned interesting things about what it means to be a celebrity in America through the own recognition you've achieved as film critics.
A long time ago, I interviewed Michael Caine. He came to America to make a movie called Hurry Sundown with Otto Preminger, after having become a success in Alfie and the Ipcress File. And I said, what does it feel like to be a movie star? And he said, you can't go into a dirty bookstore anymore. He said, I tried it. He says, in England, we don't have the kind of pornography you have over here, but I'd heard about the stores in Times Square. And so I looked in through the window of one of them. I was curious. You remember Michael Caine at this time was in his 20s, young man, first trip to America.
Yeah.
I looked in through the window with my trained actor's eye. I wish I could do his Cockney accent. With my trained actor's eye, I quickly realized that there was no eye contact in a porno store. Everybody looks as tunnel vision. Nobody looks at anybody else. And I realized, he says, and this is the way an actor would notice this. And I congratulated myself. I said, Michael, you can walk right in there because nobody will look at you. So I walked right in. But he said, unfortunately, there was a gent on an elevated stool with a microphone whose job it was to say, okay, gents, this isn't a library, make your purchases. And he got on his microphone and said, look who we have in the rubberware section, Michael Caine. And to a degree, that's, when he told me that, I was not on television. I didn't realize that's what happens. You can't flip the bird to anybody in traffic. You always have to be nice to people on the elevator because they know who you are and they're going to tell everyone, if you were not nice. And whatever you do, it's going to get back to you or...
And enlarged.
Enlarged, yeah.
Now, has that affected the way you interview movie stars? Because you've experienced to some extent...
Well, I'll tell you what has affected me more, and I've thought about that, because the first big star I interviewed was John Wayne, and I was completely intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
It was during the filming of the Green Berets, and there was an overhead shot that was being set up so nobody out of uniform could be visible on this airfield. So they told him on a walkie-talkie that the interviewer was there, and he came walking in full battle fatigues with a helmet and a rifle and a sidearm and a radio and a canteen and grenades and a backpack and boots and knives and, you know, bayonets, walking toward me for about a quarter of a mile. And I couldn't move. I had to wait in the shade. He got up to me, he stuck out a hand, and he said, "John Wayne." And I said, "I know." And later, as I began to interview people of comparable stature who were younger, such as Robert De Niro or Meryl Streep, I realized a funny thing. For all of us, movie stars are the people who were stars when we were growing up. If they're your age or younger, they're just people.
Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel recorded last February at a benefit for public radio station WBEZ on the Chicago campus of Northwestern University. The interview was produced by Art Ellis.